WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. My guest is commentator and author Kevin Phillips. His new book about the Bush family is called American Dynasty: Aristocracy, Fortune, and the Politics of Deceit in the House of Bush. Phillips, once a Republican strategist for Richard Nixon, takes a harsh look at four generations of the Bush family. He concludes the family's ties to oil, investment banking, and the intelligence community have allowed the Bushes to reward friends and build political power. Phillips is the author of 9 books, including The Politics of Rich and Poor and Wealth and Democracy. He writes for several publications and is a commentator for National Public Radio. I spoke to Kevin Phillips last week. Kevin Phillips, welcome to Fresh Air.
My pleasure.
Your book introduces us to some of the Bush family ancestors that most Americans have probably never heard of, but were important and influential people in their day. Let's meet some of them. Now, you introduce us to George Herbert Walker, who I believe was the first President Bush's maternal grandfather. Tell us about what he did for a living, why he's important in this family's legacy.
George H. Walker was really the Joe Kennedy of the Bush family. He was the founding father, the man who made the bigger bucks and made the bigger connections. He was a financier based in St. Louis, and during World War I, he managed to sort of jump his profile a bit and become active in wartime finance and in terms of arranging things that were made in the United States and went over to Europe. And by the end of the war, he had made enough of a mark that Averell Harriman, who was the heir to the Union Pacific fortune, wanted to enlist George H. Walker in his new brokerage firm, W.A. Harriman & Company, which they did. And during the 1920s, they got involved in quite a few businesses and investment opportunities in both Germany and Russia. And as a result of this, really what they were doing was combining a kind of political intelligence operation with business and commerce in two countries that were thought to be enormously important, not just as markets, but given the political future of Europe. And as a result, George H. Walker made himself into an important behind-the-scenes player in both Washington and New York.
So it was George Herbert Walker's daughter, Dorothy, I believe, who married Prescott Bush. Is that right?
Yes.
And then Prescott Bush and George Herbert Walker and the Harriman investment banking business were an important link here.
Absolutely. You had, in addition to George H. Walker, Prescott Bush's father, Sam Bush, had been a major regulator of the munitions industry in the United States during World War I. And Prescott Bush, when he got out of Yale in 1917, briefly went into the Army, and when he came back to the United States in 1919, he found himself, because of both his father's connections and other connections, in industries that had basically had something to do with the war. Equipment, heavy steel construction, rubber, and that's where he worked until 1926, when he became a vice president of W.A. Harriman & Company, essentially working for his father-in-law, George H. Walker.
Now, you write that the Bush family had some business associations with Nazi Germany. Tell us about that.
Well, the associations they had grew up during the pre-Nazi period, during Weimar Germany. And essentially, they were across quite a spectrum of the German economy. Harriman and Walker took a participation in the Hamburg-America lines. They'd been the biggest steamship line in the world before World War I, and as a result of World War I, they were sort of out of luck and out of ships, and Walker and Harriman got some of the ships and became involved in the management of the Hamburg-America line. They also worked with the Thyssen steel interest in Germany and wound up setting up a bank for the Thyssen steel interest that was in New York, but was owned by a bank in Rotterdam, Holland, and ultimately was owned in Berlin. Now, they got into some other things, too, zinc mining. They had participations in the German transatlantic cable. They did some bond issues in Germany. They were a major player. in Germany. But this is before Hitler. You have to underscore this.
Right.
However, their links to Germany continued into the 1930s. And this is where the framework of knowledge becomes pretty thin. There was a bank, the Union Banking Corporation, set up, as I mentioned, for the Thyssen Steel interest. And that bank continued until 1942. Prescott Bush was a director. And in 1942, its assets were seized by the alien property custodian because it was German and the United States went to war.
So when Hitler came to power in 1933 in Germany and his intentions became increasingly apparent throughout the 30s, how did the Bush family and the Walkers respond to that? I mean, did they divest from that or did they maintain those investments?
Well, we can say with considerable accuracy that they didn't divest. They didn't shut down the bank. Now, I suppose they could have. They didn't shut down the zinc mine connection on the Polish-German border. They did keep some links with the Hamburg-America line by the middle 30s, but it's not clear that they really amounted to too much. Now, there are records in some books. There are several books written about the intelligence community and the operators who were working for the some of the New York investment firms in Germany in the late 1930s. And several books cited one individual as being the German go-between for one of the big New York banks and for Brown Brothers Harriman. Now, Prescott Bush was involved with German accounts, but we don't know exactly what those German accounts were. We don't know what the go-between did for Brown Brothers Harriman in Germany. There's only one transaction that can be linked to Brown Brothers Harriman that I can be specific about, and that's they provided some sort of security or collateral for a transfer of or a provision of tetraethyl gasoline from the United States to the German Luftwaffe in 1938. But the record is really very thin on all of this.
Well, including this material in the book, of course, inevitably is going to raise the question of whether the Walkers or the Bushes were really patriotic at a critical time in American history. What's your judgment?
Well, my judgment is that during the 1930s, the late 1930s and early 1940s, they were so close to other people in Brown Brothers Harriman who were involved in the intelligence community. I mean, for example, there was Robert A. Lovett, another partner in Brown Brothers Harriman, who after World War II became the Secretary of Defense and was the architect of the CIA. So I can't imagine that they weren't close to those people. In 1941, the New York Herald Tribune published a front-page article on Union Banking Corporation, referred to the possibility that it was holding money for Hitler cronies. And the people at Brown Brothers Harriman, including Prescott Bush, had already been speaking to the New York State banking superintendent about should they get out of the bank, should they leave the board there, what should they do? And I think it's quite clear that far from being in bed with Hitler, which is kind of ridiculous, they were obviously pretty close to the intelligence community and probably reporting on things in Germany. By the end of World War II, quite a few people who had been involved in some sort of economic relations with Germany in the 1930s emerged as important people in the intelligence community because they obviously could give advice and probably a little more than that during the war.
So rather than being profiteers from the Nazi war effort, it appears they might have been using their commercial links to play a patriotic role in helping military intelligence.
Yes, I think that you have to draw that conclusion because of the large number of people that they were involved with who wound up in the War Department, the State Department, and the OSS, which was the intelligence service during World War II. Having said that, it's equally clear that they were involved in commercial relationships with Germany after 1933. But the overwhelming aspect of this is that they had to be involved at the same time with the intelligence community.
All right. So Prescott Bush is a senator for many years. It is his son, who is George Herbert Walker Bush, who at a relatively young age does not follow the footsteps of his forebears and go into investment banking, but sets off to Texas. This is an important move in a sort of an aristocratic family, isn't it, to relocate Southwest?
Well, it's an interesting move because it can have a number of interpretations. The Texas oil fields, the West Texas oil fields, the Permian Basin, were attracting a lot of people from the Northeast, from families that had quite a bit of money, and a lot of them went to Midland, which is where George H.W. Bush himself wound up. That was kind of an outpost of the Ivy League, and they had streets named for Harvard, Yale, and Princeton, and it was all very Northeastern in some ways. But it's also clear that he went out there because he wanted to get out of his father's sort of white shoe investment community. But what he did, in addition to going to this pot of black gold out in Midland with oil, he got involved with a firm where his father had been a director for, at this point, 15 years, Dresser Industries, which is now part of Halliburton. And Dresser Industries was not just an oil service firm, but as World War II came along, with the help of Prescott Bush, who had a lot of connections, they got to work on many, many defense contracts, including the atomic bomb project.
So in moving to Texas, you don't see this as a real departure from the family's historical relationships to investment banking, to energy, and to intelligence. It transplanted it to Southwest.
Yes, in my opinion, that's exactly what was going on. Before George H.W. Bush went to Texas to work with Dresser Industries, he'd been lined up, or his father had lined up, a possible job in Tulsa, Oklahoma, with a man named Ray Kravis, who was one of the great experts on the tax shelter aspects of the oil industry and on all the ways in which you could set up deals that would maximize the profit. In my opinion, he was really doing Wall Street-type work, even when he was in Texas half the time, at least.
My guest is political commentator and author Kevin Phillips. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're back with author and commentator Kevin Phillips. His new book is called American Dynasty: Aristocracy, Fortune, and the Politics of Deceit in the House of Bush. Now, you note that one of the themes of the Bush family over four generations was its involvement with the nation's intelligence community. And, of course, we know that George Herbert Walker Bush actually headed the CIA in the late 70s. But I'm wondering, did you find evidence of earlier contact between George Herbert Walker Bush and the CIA when he was involved in the oil business?
I found what we'd have to call circumstantial evidence, and let me go through that. It's not obviously legal proof in the sense that you don't have what would be necessary for a courtroom, but I think we have some of what's necessary for a historical evaluation. The people who've looked at this have weighed the different times during which George Herbert Walker Bush could have become connected with the CIA or its earlier framework, the OSS. A few think that maybe when he went into the Navy during World War II, he actually had an OSS connection that allowed him to get pilot training, even though he didn't meet the requirements. More think that, when he was at Yale, of all the universities in the United States, was the great source of people going into the intelligence community and CIA. There's just an awful lot of that. The connections were so strong that people would joke about hearing the Whiff and Poof song being hummed in the corridors of the CIA. So maybe it was a Yale connection. But the bulk of the betting is that the connection came when he was in the offshore oil drilling business, principally in the Caribbean, through a company named Zapata Offshore. And this, again, was financed by his uncle, who was also a Yale man and very interested in things having to do with cloak and dagger stuff. And the thought is that by the late 1950s or early 1960s, as the United States was getting more and more interested in what was going on with Fidel Castro in Cuba, that Zapata Offshore might have been a conduit or an asset of the CIA in terms of surveillance of Cuba and possibly even preparation for the Bay of Pigs invasion. That seems to be the larger speculation. I've seen that in four or five different places.
Kevin Phillips, you write that the Bush family's rise was very much associated with what you call crony capitalism. Explain this and give us an example.
Well, crony capitalism is basically when, you know, deals are made between friends and associates and not in a very public way, behind the scenes with connections and odd obligations and funny reasons for investing. Now, if you look at the history of the Bushes from the standpoint of crony capitalism, you get the first generation of George Herbert Walker and Sam Bush, and obviously they had a whole lot of friends in business, in finance, in various military production firms, and they did a lot of this on the QT. Nobody knew exactly what was going on, so it's fair to say there was an element of crony capitalism here in these interlocking directorates and deals that came during and after World War I. By the time you get to Prescott Bush, when you're talking about crony capitalism, you're talking about a firm, which was Brown Brothers Harriman, in which crony capitalism was really the name of the game, but in a pretty elevated sense. They'd all been at school together. They worked together. The Dresser Industries, where George Herbert Walker Bush had his first job in Texas, had been reorganized by these people in 1929, and Prescott Bush became a director of it. Really closely participated in running Dresser because head of it was his friend who he'd helped get the job. And so small wonder the friend appointed his son to a position after World War II. Cronyism, in an honest, fairly upfront way, was the name of the game. But when you start getting into Texas oil in the 1950s and 60s, and especially when George W., the current president, gets into the act, he financed his businesses in ways that were much more a question of people investing money who didn't really expect to get paid back. And the argument is that they invested because they were dealing with the son of the vice president or president. And there was quite a bit of that in his Arbusto partnership in the late 1970s and quite a bit of it in the late 1980s in his being bought out by Harkin Energy. And these are other portraits, and the other brothers, both of George Bush Sr. and George W. Bush, were likewise involved in some of the same crony capitalist ventures.
It's one thing, of course, for a business to hire friends and relatives. I mean, that happens all the time. It's another thing if private interests reap profits either at taxpayer expense or with special privileges or information that they get from the government. One of the things you write about is the Bush administration's ties to Enron and the Enron collapse. Now, President George W. Bush described that as a business scandal, not a political scandal. What connections did you find between the Bushes and the Enron collapse?
Well, the answer is many, many, many. The notion that this is just a business scandal and not a political scandal is a joke, because Enron didn't even exist under that name until 1985-86, and it went from being just a minor blip in the corporate system to, by the years 2000 and 2001, a company that was growing so fast that some of its own executives thought it would become the largest in the world within a couple of years. Now, a lot of this had to do with Enron's connection with the Bushes. You also have to say that a number of Democratic politicians, including the Clinton White House, were involved with helping Enron, too. But the Bushes' role was much more prominent. Ken Lay was a natural gas executive who came from Houston. By the early 1980s, he had become involved in a fairly small way with George H.W. Bush when Bush was vice president, and he was in charge of planning a lot of the energy deregulation moves of the Reagan administration. And he became fairly close to Lay, and George W. Bush became close to Lay, too. And by the time we have 1988 and George Bush Sr. is about to be elected president, right after he was elected, George W. Bush called up a high Argentine official to push for Enron to be considered for a pipeline. So obviously they were getting friendly even before George Bush became the president. And when he was the president, he appointed Lay to the President's Export Council. He appointed Lay to be the host and arranger of one of the G7 economic meetings that was taking place in Texas. He positioned him to be credible with the U.S. agencies that are vital to a company trying to go into international business, which Lay was. And because of these connections, Lay was able to get financing from the Export-Import Bank, the Overseas Private Investment Corporation, and he was able to put Enron in a number of situations around the world with the help of the federal government. He also profited enormously under the Bushes from various stages of deregulation. But that picks up on another angle, and that's a longer story, too.
Commentator and author Kevin Phillips. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies of the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. Let's get back to our conversation with commentator and author Kevin Phillips, whose new book takes a critical look at four generations of the Bush family. It's called American Dynasty, Aristocracy, Fortune, and the Politics of Deceit in the House of Bush. You know, I wonder if the Bushes can be seen as a dynasty any more than any other power. We've had powerful political families in the past, the Kennedys, the Tafts. I mean, even Al Gore's dad was a senator. I mean, are they different?
What to me is different about the Bushes dynastically is the importance of their power at the presidential level. The other dynasties, take the Kennedys, just got one president. They tried for more, but they couldn't do it. With the Roosevelts, you had, yes, two presidents, but they were 20 years apart and they were in different parties. The Adamses, two presidents, but 24 years apart and in different parties. What you had with the Bushes was a strong continuity, as I've mentioned, between the 41st president and the 43rd, a passage of only 8 years, and then looking back at the four generations of Bushes. Before you had the two presidents, you also had the grandfather of the current president, who was a senator from Connecticut. When he left office, his wife later said that by the late 1950s, early 1960s, he had thought and discussed with her that if he'd gotten involved in politics earlier, he could have been president. So they've been thinking about becoming presidents in three generations over nearly 50 years. That's really unusual to have that continuity, to have them come out of steadily the same sort of interest groups, finance, oil, military, industrial complex, and intelligence. So I regard it as a dynasty. I don't think that these other parallels are really there. This is much more.
Now, Kevin Phillips, it's interesting to see this book, which is so harshly critical of the Bush family, coming from a man with a long history, early history as a Republican. You worked on the Nixon campaign in the 60s and wrote a widely quoted book about the Republican strategy that was so successful in the last half of the last part of the 20th century. And I'm wondering, you know, a lot of people who are now in their 50s who were leftist radicals in college look back at their old selves and kind of laugh. And I'm interested in your ideological migration and whether you look at the Kevin Phillips of 30 years ago and think you were wrong. Or did the party change?
Well, I guess I probably wouldn't do exactly the things that I did back then over again, because we all know things from a later perspective. But I wouldn't do it too differently. The thing that I had a sense of very strongly in the late 1960s and early 1970s was being for a politics that was changing the alignments between the parties so that the Republicans could represent a conservative axis that went across the old Mason-Dixon line and stood for more middle America as opposed to the country clubs and the mahogany panel rooms and the old stereotypical Republican loyalty patterns. And part of the reasons I didn't like the Bushes is that I always had the sense that George Sr. basically stood for the whole very important backroom club member, select family, social register type of Republicanism that basically wasn't interested in the average American and didn't support the type of Republican policies and party alignment that I did. Interestingly, in 1990, I wrote a book called The Politics of Rich and Poor, which was critical of some of Reagan's economics, but especially critical of the whole socioeconomic loyalty pattern of the Bush family, George H.W. in particular. The lead quote on the back of the book jacket of The Politics of Rich and Poor came from Richard M. Nixon, who shared my doubts about the elitist economics of Bush. So I feel, yes, I've changed, but under the Bushes in particular, The party has moved away from me, and it represents something it didn't used to represent. I can go back in great length describe how many Republicans, beginning with Nixon, but including Ronald Reagan and others, really did not think much of George Bush Sr. and had a lot of doubts about him. Ross Perot was another Republican that was motivated to run against him. He called Bush Sr. a rabbit. He couldn't stand him. John McCain ran against Bush the Younger and had major doubts. So, yes, I've changed, but I think that the rise of the Bushes within the Republican Party to the point of really controlling it for much of the last quarter century has not gone down so well with some other old-time Republicans, and I do hear from some of them.
I mean, what struck me about the book is that I've never seen this picture of the Bushes, and yet most of the material has been there. I mean, did you feel that sort of you were looking at the truth that was hidden in plain view?
Well, there's an interesting history to this. There were no independent biographies written about George Bush Sr. until the last year of his presidential administration, when a pair of Time reporters wrote a very good book. But prior to that time, the only books that had been written were two by people who were either social friends of Bush or one who had worked for him at the United Nations. And then a couple of books that were basically looking at Bush and his war record in the South Pacific, and they were admiring portraits of his time as a very youthful Navy pilot. So basically, the family flew under the radar. And in 1992, when Bush was defeated, everybody figured, well, he's gone. They didn't think that the son would come back, but they knew he was gone. So there really wasn't any visitation of all this information, which is, as you say, available from public sources. You can put it together. But I thought, because I saw a continuity between all the Bushes, and especially George Bush Sr. and George W. Bush, that it was time to put it all together. And that's the book.
Well, Kevin Phillips, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Commentator Kevin Phillips. His new book is American Dynasty, Aristocracy, Fortune, and the Politics of Deceit in the House of Bush.